You are listening to Radio Albion.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another edition of the Orthodox Nationalist. This is Matthew Raphael Johnson. And for my friends on the old calendar, today is Christmas Day, or the Nativity, as we should call it. When my kids were little, we celebrated on the 25th as like a, you know, Santa Christmas, the presents and all that stuff. The evening of the 6th was reserved for the liturgical and spiritual elements of it. So there was never this confusion of the Santa Christmas on the one hand and liturgy on the other. My kids grew up to see them as two different things. And of course, with St. Nicholas, the actual St. Nicholas, we don't have to worry about the whole Santa Claus thing. St. Nicholas was quite real. But an attachment even to Western Christmas, as Seraphim Rose says, is a very, very healthy instinct, regardless of the lack of liturgical content. So today we're going to talk about a very important topic. As far as I'm concerned, as a Russia specialist, one of the essential topics that comes up all the time in discussions on the monarchy. I was on a radio program of a guy who I've recently come into contact with, Peter Kionis, who I strongly recommend, by the way. And he wanted to talk about the pogroms of late Imperial Russia. And we're talking here mostly late 19th century up until something like 1907. This comes up a lot. There's a lot of books by Jewish authors with somewhere in the title, this is the precursor to the Holocaust. And these events have a very prominent place in the elite Jewish mind, especially in their approach to history. They're very important because they're an extremely common way to attack the crown, or really just Russians in general, because this was actually part of the whole fable, was that Russians are just inherently evil. So, and while this is, I covered this many years ago, I want to revisit it, and regularly revisit it, because it is very important. We have plenty of people talking about the Holocaust in the 40s, very few talking about this one, and the same rhetoric was used. So let me give you the official story here. The official story is that roughly from the late 19th century till the First World War, Jews in Russia, especially in the Western Russian cities, were targeted by the Black Hundreds in league with the state in what's called pogrom attacks, for no reason. Or at the very most, they were jealous of Jewish money. Now, the term is an interesting one. The pogrom is a buzzword created at the time, and it's a term like Holocaust that's meant to separate this kind of violence from any other kind of violence. The term pogrom is of Yiddish origin, but it does have a Russian background, of course, and used in the Russian context. And it's made up of two words, po, which is a preposition, by or through, something like that, and gromu, or angry thunder. Thunder in Russian as a noun is grom. That, in turn, actually comes from the Aryan root word, grem, where we get terms like grim, And it was a neologism. The term was completely non-existent until roughly 1900. And the role of the media in propagating a lot of this was extremely important. These were riots where defenseless Jews were attacked by whatever group you want, you know, the Black Hundreds, Russian Orthodox, whatever, essentially became riots, and they killed tens of thousands, maybe more, Jews being the sole victims. The violence was instigated not just by these groups, but of course the church and even the Tsar due to blind hate. Many others have noted the whole fact that Jews are just sitting ducks all the time, doing nothing but benefiting all mankind and then attacked out of envy or hatred. It's the common motif, but I don't have to tell you what the conclusion is here. None of it is true. When you go through the records, and it was Solzhenitsyn's 200 Years Together who mentions this and got me into it, and I discovered quite a bit of both the Russian and English language literature on the topic. And while this paper, I'm not going to publish it on Patreon, it was in the Barnes Review years ago, and of course this is an updated version. When you go through the records of the time, that includes local media, as well as whatever records people like Platonov could come across, in these riots, they seem to have a few things in common. Number one, very few Jews were killed. Overwhelmingly, it was Russians and all of these that suffered the most. Number two, that Jewish militias were almost always the aggressors. And number three, the Jews were far better armed than the local police forces in places like, you know, Stadov, Odessa, even Kiev itself. And there's a reason for this. This was the first time that this modern mass media was used to promote Jewish victimhood. Now, here in a minute, we'll talk about the numbers they came up with. 6 million is one of the, is a common one at the time. But part of the reason for it is to cover over leftists and overwhelmingly Jewish terrorism in this same period of time. Just in 1 year, the revolutionary year of 1905 to 1906, the socialist revolutionaries murdered 15 governors, 267 security officials, and 12 bishops. That's just in 1 year. Everyone killed by leftist terror between 1905 and 1907 is about 20,000. And this, they often targeted low-level bureaucrats and civilians. And to cover that up is very important, plus the fact that whenever Jewish attacks on the church are brought up in mainstream society, the pogroms are very convenient to use to say, well, this is why they hated the church so much. Now, rarely they'll admit that Jews were involved in this, but the pogroms serve, you know, a number of purposes. This fable has a lot of work to do. Like all of these things, it's a mass media phenomenon accepted due to Johnson's Law in the U.S. Because, frankly, no one knew the first thing about Russia at the turn of the 20th century in the U.S. and a bit less so in Britain. Not to mention the British had been promoting the Russian savage idea since at least the Crimean War, if not prior to that. In 200 Years Together, which I think to this day has not been entirely translated into English. I think maybe there's a French one, but I don't know. Solzhenitsyn brings this topic up. And the phenomenon of the pogrom began after the murder of Alexander II by Jewish revolutionaries. And in that pogrom, the Jewish capital of the Russian Empire, which was Odessa, one Jew was killed. Troops were very quickly sent in to quell, these are very important cities, to stop all violence, no matter what was going on. Of course, Russians were attacked all over the place by very well-armed Jewish militia in Western Russia. You did see retaliations to that. And even prior to that, the Greeks were involved in violence for Jewish unethical business practices. And these accusations were constant. So Greek merchants sometimes were a part of it. It seems that any public expression of loyalty to the crown or to the church, Easter processions were attacked all the time. The interior minister at the time, Count Ignatieff, is commonly said to have ordered these pogroms, but in fact, he crushed it. But 2,000 were arrested just in Kiev after this. But it's important to keep in mind that these westernized, very wealthy regions recently brought in from the Polish Empire was the key to a certain amount of financial success in the West. That means the Russian monarchy wanted absolutely nothing to do with any violence out there. Some of you may remember when I spoke of Gabriel Dyrzhavin's, the Dyrzhavin Committee, Emperor Paul I and Alexander I, where they sent him to try to figure out why the peasants hated the Jews so much, the turn of the 19th century, Russia. I mean, they were very naive about the whole thing. In Ukraine, the Polish Empire, you had a huge Jewish population. But it wasn't until the partitions of Poland, the very end of the 18th century, that do you have a couple of million Jews being brought in to the Russian Empire. And they weren't used to dealing with them. Well, they got used to dealing with them. And it was right after that, within a few decades, all of a sudden you have the Jewish revolutionary movement. And it's not an accident that the core of the Russian nationalist movement was in Ukraine. There was an article, a series of articles by Andrew Joyce, which, by the way, I have to apologize to him and the Occidental Observer because I said his name was Royce for a long time. I'm sure that irritated him to no end. I'm sorry for that. But there has been some, Andrew Joyce has excellent pieces of work published in 2012, which I highly recommend. And then the Jewish historian, John Clear, who I had heard of before, but didn't read until Joyce's work came out. And this comes up in Oleg Platonov's work quite often. And if I include myself here, that's the core of the group of people who have popped the mythical bubble of the pogroms in this era. And that's become, you know, one of the most critical and important aspects of the Jewish myth. Joyce does an excellent job in dealing with the motives for the myth, where it came from, and the forms that it took. Now, I'm going to quote him, and he has many, many things like this. But this is kind of a summary of what he's talking about. In the pages of the British Daily Telegraph, it was stated that these Russian atrocities are just the beginning. The Russian officials themselves countenance these barbarities. Around this time in continental Europe, Prussian Rabbi Yitzhak Ruf established himself as an intermediary between Eastern Jewry and the West, and according to Clear, one of his specialties was the spreading of sensationalized accounts of mass rape. Other major sources of pogrom atrocity stories are the New York Times, of course, the London Times, and the Jewish World. And it would be the Jewish World that furnished the majority of these tales, having sent a reporter to visit areas that had suffered pogroms. Most of the other papers simply reprinted what the Jewish World reporter sent them. The atrocity stories carried by these newspapers provoked global outrage. There were large-scale public protests against Russia in Paris, Brussels, London, Vienna, even in Australia. However, it was in the United States that public indignation had reached its height. Historian Edward Judge states that the American public was spurred on by reports of brutal beatings, multiple rapes, dismemberment of corpses, senseless laughter, painful suffering, and unbearable grief. In other words, this was an organized attempt to discredit the Russian monarchy, assuming that it had credit in the West, And unfortunately, it succeeded. These atrocity stories were false. They didn't happen, but they had the desired effect. Johnson's Law is key here, because if you don't think Westerners know anything about Russia now, around 1905, it was far worse. But the Russian press itself, the popular press, from 1906 to the Great War, is a frightening spectacle. They were totally free from state control. Get rid of this myth of the censorship of the press. They should have, but they didn't. And not just in the Jewish issue, but journalists invented the worst stories for quick sales. There was no connection of journalism and truth, nor has there ever really been. There was no censorship of the press. Prior to, at any time in the reign of Nicholas II, and certainly nothing systematic, nothing like you have today in the U.S. Now, I mentioned John Clear. He's an Israeli historian. I don't know if he's still around. And he's the one, given his background, he teaches in Israel. And as Joyce mentions, this special correspondent that was sent around and created these atrocity stories, and Clear says that he's simply lying. He says that most of his accounts of all of these terrible rapes were flatly contradicted by the archival record. And now I'm taking from the Joyce article again, where he's quoted as his claim that 20 rioters were killed during the Kishinev pogrom in Ukraine in 1881 was a simple fabrication, since there were no records of any violence at the time there. His accounts were ridiculous. And when you don't know about a topic, when you have a fear, possibly, of this unknown group of people, it's not difficult to convince people that they are dark and wicked. But this Jewish World series of articles became immensely influential in manipulating how the Western elites thought of not just these events, but of Russia and the Crown more specifically. Again, quoting from the Clear book, that this reporter portrayed the pogroms dramatically as great in scale and inhuman in their brutality. He reported numerous accounts where Jews were burned alive in their homes while the authorities looked on. You guys have noticed, it doesn't matter what part of the world, when the regime wants to create an atrocity story, they say the same things over and over and over again. Something to do with hurting babies. You know, for some reason, this is what they decide to do. Burning people alive. Chopping off breasts. Now, that's a fixation of some kind. I've seen it everywhere in these make-believe stories. The mutilation of women, even down to cannibalism and necrophilia. Whatever they can come up with. But the fact that these are identical, just fill in the blank with a different country or a different leader. You know, they're not very creative about this. If an atrocity story sounds like this, then there's a good chance that it's false. But one of the reasons this stuff ever came into existence, and the reason it became so popular in the West, is that this covered over what the left was doing and would do in Russia in the coming years. The Jewish World, and this is before the main line of the pogroms, 1881, there were 25 rapes in Kiev, including 5 deaths that come from it. And rape was all over his reporting. They didn't want to talk too much about murder and looting, but because in the Anglo-American world, rapes generated the most outrage. And again, that comes from both Clear book and that's described in the Joyce paper. But even beyond that, the Russian press, you know, when I was much younger, I thought the Russian press was, this is a medieval society. It was tightly controlled from St. Petersburg, but they, you know, the state was so small it was so difficult to enforce anything from thousands of miles away, the press did what they pleased. During World War I, they called him the corrupt Prussian Tsar. Although he was a popular man, they usually left him alone, but they went after his ministers and allies, inventing the ridiculous stories about Rasputin. And just like they do now, they predicted the imminent collapse of the Russian economy pretty much every few months. Now, I want to quote Solzhenitsyn concerning the press coverage of this. In St. Petersburg, you see frantic newspaper articles read about the murders of women and infants, and on numerous occasions, the rape of underage girls, wives raped in the presence of their husbands or parents. One Jew had his belly ripped open and the insides came out. A Jewish woman had nails driven into her head through her nostrils. Within the same week, the Western papers reprinted exactly these. They unconditionally believed the Russian press. Britain's leading Jews completely relied on these terrible articles and incorporated them into their protest slogans. And it gets worse than that, since these articles are still being quoted from by historians who apparently don't have a shred of critical thought. Critical thought is dangerous. The press in Russia, nothing like it is today in the U.S., but it was very Jewish. The crown at the time didn't grasp the importance of propaganda. And I understand from the monarchist point of view, journalism was muckraking. It was creating a sensation. That was the point of a journalist. You hired a journalist to do your PR. It wasn't meant to be a serious profession. Maybe it could be. But the crown was supposed to be above polemics and these harsh debates. His job was that of a unifier. Not even the royalist press, such as it was. You had a couple of good, the Union of the Russian People, among a few others. The Union of the Russian People in Ukraine was enormous. But they didn't receive a penny from the government. The crown didn't understand propaganda. It was vulgar. It was new. It's hard to blame them, but they paid for it. But even Sergei Vita, who was a philo-Semite, said that St. Petersburg media was Jewish. D.I. Pikno, who was the editor of the Kiev Daily, said that Russian society understood that in such moments the power of the press was immense, and in the hands of his opponents, that is, Tsar Nicholas's opponents, who spoke on behalf of Russia, society was lost in a mass of lies they could barely understand. Now, everyone's heard of William Randolph Hearst, a sacred figure, I suppose, in American media. Because he had been fed a diet of these stories, this was from the Baltimore Sun in 1903, here's what he said. Again, a powerful, wealthy oligarch. "We accuse the Russian government of bearing the responsibility for the Chisina slaughter. We declare that this Holocaust is steeped in blood. It is on Nicholas's door that lie these killings and violence. May the God of justice come into this world and finish Russia as he finished with Sodom and Gomorrah, sweeping this hotbed of hate from the earth as a plague." I mentioned the town of Chisina. Again, another West Russian town. But you hear that type of rhetoric today from somebody who, by his own admission, didn't know the first thing about what was going on out there. It was a Jewish author, a Jewish paper. They're being cited by everybody, therefore it must be true. Even the immigrant movement later, once the Bolsheviks took over, they didn't offer much of an alternative because they didn't speak English, nor did they attempt to. So you have elites calling on the genocide of Russians based on ridiculous press reports that were never verified because they didn't happen. Now, I found something in my studies here that shocked me. There were leftist groups who truly believed that the revolution was to do away with concentrated capital. And because the Jews had a huge amount of capital, the left must be against them, right? And this is from the Black Reparation Workers Leaflet. And it goes back to June of 1881. And this came from Solzhenitsyn. I would not have come across this otherwise. And here's what they say in one of these leaflets. Not only all the governors, but all other officials, police, troops, priests, zemstvo, and journalists stood up for the Kulak Jews. The government protects the person and property of the Jews. Threats are announced by the governors that the perpetrators of the riots will be dealt with according to the full extent of the law. The police looked for people who were in the crowd, arrested them, dragged them to the police station. Soldiers and Cossacks used the rifle butt and the whip. They beat the people with rifles and whips. Some were prosecuted and locked up in jail or sent to do hard labor, while others were thrashed with birches on the spot by the police. Now, that's a very interesting leaflet. This black reparations worker movement was very naive. Here, they fully admit that the pogroms were... They say that the pogroms may have happened, but it was from the working class against the capitalists, which they associated with the Jews. And by the way, this is a very early use of the word kulak. And Kulak Jews kind of has a hyphen between them. And so the assumption was that because the Jews were so wealthy, this is why the government protects them. And of course, I'm sure this is very early, 1881. They were disabused of this idea. Yeah, if you truly hated oligarchy, yeah, that would be the first group of people you'd go after, right? But of course, that's not the point. But it also goes to show that even amongst communists, it was clear that the authorities were doing everything it could to stop any riot, whether it be retaliatory or anything else, partially because these are wealthy areas that were key to Russian prosperity. So these guys saw it as protecting the bourgeoisie rather than, you know, defending the elite population. And you do come across anti-Jewish talk amongst far-left communists in the era. And we talked about Bakunin many times, but he's one of many. The anarchists were no friends of theirs. Later on, they became. But in an environment like this, rumors spread pretty rapidly. And there were no standards in the media, so confirming information was extremely difficult. In the 1880s, there were examples of peasants rising up because they were told that the Tsar had ordered action against the Jews. And it's a deliberate fostering of confusion. Now, we know we live in a society today where violence against Jews is far worse than violence against anybody else. Every once in a while, someone like the head of the ADL will say something like that. But as we talked about many times in the past, there were very, very good reason for anger against the Jews in places like Starodubid and Odessa. And some of these cities, you know, Jews were 25-30% of the population. Now, I want to quote someone I've mentioned already, the interior minister, Ignatiev. And he says this... during that period of time of, you know, Bloody Sunday and all the rest. Recognizing the harm to the Christian population from the Jewish economic activities, their tribal exclusivity and religious fanaticism in the last 20 years, the government has tried to blend the Jews with the rest of the population using a whole row of initiatives, and has also almost made Jews equal in rights with the native inhabitants. However, the present anti-Jewish movement incontrovertibly proves that despite all the efforts of the government, the relations between the Jews and the native population of these regions remain abnormal, as in the past, and it's because of these economic issues. After the easing of civil restrictions, the Jews have not only seized commerce and trade, but they have acquired significant landed property. Moreover, because of their cohesion and solidarity, they have, with few exceptions, directed all their efforts not towards the increase of the productive strength of the state, but primarily towards the exploitation of the poorest classes of the surrounding population. Most Russians, after the Polish partitions, were more or less neutral on the Jewish question, which is why the commission was put together in the first place. Sometimes they would think that the peasants were just being primitive in their contempt for the Jews, but it didn't take long for people like Ignatieff to realize what the core of the problem is. And several Jewish writers are not shy about that either. Now, there's so many myths about Russia and the Jews at the end of the empire. But the notion that they couldn't own land, that they couldn't engage in certain occupations, or they couldn't leave the Pale of Settlement, these are stories. On the contrary, the state offered every conceivable incentive, as Ignatieff mentions, to get Jews to own land, to work it, to become productive outside of the cities. Free land, free implements, seed money, everything else. You had a handful of families who did it, but overwhelmingly it was rejected. We know now, of course, that since the soil, other than Israel, of course, was unclean, you're not going to see Jews tilling the land, despite all the free transportation, free everything. But unfortunately for the Jews at the time, Jewish behavior, whether it be in the Polish Empire that the Cossacks fought so hard against, or the western part of the Russian Empire in the late imperial period, Jewish behavior was abominable. Again, the Russian state could not afford its wealthiest and most strategic cities to go up in flames. Places like Kishinev, Gomel, Starodub, these were critical economic hubs. Now, in the 1897 census, Jews comprised 4% of the population of the entire empire, which was a huge jump from, say, 100 years prior. Classes did not have hard and fast boundaries, but they were legal categories. And one of those classes was a merchant. The merchant class numbered a total of 618,926 people. Of that number, 450,427 were Jews, roughly two-thirds. And like Ignatieff and most other people at the time will say, they created a cartel that was then able to plug into an international network no one else had access to. And while they wouldn't charge interest against each other, they would charge it only to Gentiles, and really based on how much they can get away with. One of the most important takeaways from all of this is Jews in the major Western Russian cities, Ukraine and Belarus, were extremely numerous. They were well-organized, wealthy, and very well-armed. They were a privileged caste. They were better off than the Russians that they lived among. There was a riot. They called it a pogrom in Kiev in 1905. You had about 100 deaths, maybe a little bit more. And the final report, about 12% were Jews. So roughly 10 out of 100. But these so-called pogroms were retaliatory. Very well-armed Jewish revolutionaries made war on any public presentation of Russian Orthodox nationalism anywhere where Jews existed in large numbers. Odessa, of course, the capital, the Jewish capital of the Russian Empire, saw a massive increase in the Jewish population. There was a Black Hundred March in 1906 where a bomb was thrown in the midst of it by a guy named Jacob Breitman. In 1906, that same year in Chernigov, leaflets were eventually traced to three guys, Israel Tomgolsky, Yankel Bruck, and Pinkus Krugersky. And they called for the massacre of all royalists, the death to the Tsar, and shutting down of any non-leftist, non-Jewish newspaper. And the Duma really said the same thing in February of 1917. Where they called for the death of all royalists. But it goes farther than that. Because wherever these Western cities that had a large Jewish population, They thought that their numbers and their wealth were of a critical mass where they could cleanse the area entirely of the Orthodox. In Starodub, 1902, you had the formation of strong, disciplined militias. And in that year, a column of heavily armed Jews wanted to evict the entire Orthodox population to cleanse their region of the unclean Gentiles. It was called a pogrom only when the unclean Gentiles fought back. June 1st, 1906, the Jewish Bund, who weren't just armed with rifles, they had heavy weapons as well, attacked the Nationalist procession, killing 25. They did this on Easter all the time. In the Baltics, this is, I'm going to quote from the Vilna Gazette. And I got this from Platano. In Chisinau, the September 1903 riots saw the Jewish provocateurs and their well-armed self-defense units, showing no care about the safety of ordinary Jews, organized to attack Russians and to cause disorders. One thug, Pinkus Dashevsky, tried to shoot the Russian writer, P. Khrushchevan, with a revolver. Fortunately, the wound was not serious. The perpetrator was arrested by the Russian people and punished by the court. You notice he says the Russian people. In other words, it was a group of them. It wasn't police or anything else. The police force in old Russia was tiny. The bureaucracy was tiny, especially relative to the population. But there was an attempt to deliberately cause chaos. The belief that the government was falling, especially during the Russo-Japanese War, which I've dealt with elsewhere. These newspapers spread the stories of Russian collapse and Russian defeat, which was not true. And if you've read my article or listened to my lecture on that, you'll understand why. But the point was to remove any faith in the state, that the society was falling apart and that everyone should arm themselves against everyone else. But both the Russian press and the Western press said that this was a massacre of Jews in Chisinau. Despite the fact that there's no local evidence for this. Even further west, in Bessarabia, the Bessarabian Province News in 1903, I'm going to quote them here too. The last 3 years, the Jewish agitators of Bessarabia, particularly in Chisinau, and its underground movement strenuously preparing for war, riot, and murder. The Jewish leaders hoped that Easter was to begin the violence. On the second day of Easter, in the early morning, all Jews poured into the streets and squares of the city armed with revolvers, clubs, crowbars, knives, and sulfuric acid, and began to attack in small groups the Christians on their way to Matins. Of course, William Randolph Hearst apparently missed all of this, and none of this was published in England. This is what happens when you have a powerful press that has zero ethics. You had English language articles where some said 5,000 were killed, others 60,000, others 6 million. The truth was actively suppressed by this media, both foreign and domestic. And again, not wanting to get its hands dirty, the Crown was not involved in these kind of polemics. They failed to grasp the power of propaganda. Now, this one comes from the State Archives. On a Jewish attack in Moscow. In the night of December 9th, 1905 in Moscow, in the Aquarium Garden, there was a huge rally attended by more than 10,000 people and dozens of revolutionary militants, Jewish combat squads. Its leaders have called for the arrest of the Governor General and to seize power. The operational actions of the authorities with the help of the Cossacks, Dragoons, infantry, soon isolated the rebels. Although most of the militants managed to escape, the troops were able to disarm a considerable number of bandits. In the morning in the garden, there was found a few hundred revolvers, daggers, and knives, which were abandoned by the militants. In other words, any claim that these Jewish revolutionaries were unarmed, you know, these little frail guys counting their money in a basement somewhere, is utter nonsense, deliberately created mythology. You didn't have gun laws in the Russian Empire at the time. And even if you had them, enforcement was impossible. The sheer size of the country And this is an empire, not a country. Therefore, most of these regions, especially in the fringes, were all self-governing. But as so many, the local press said at the time, Jewish areas were long preparing for violence. Law was local, especially out there, and especially when you had money. In Odessa, there was heavy weaponry, not just pistols. The alleged defeat of Russia against Japan was one of the wedges that they were going to try to overthrow the government. It almost succeeded. Wherever they saw a chink in the armor, they attempted to exploit it. I mean, you see it today. Every month, the Financial Times reports the collapse of the Chinese or Russian economy. Every time. Over and over again. And the press, of course, both Jewish and Gentile, assisted them. Here's another one, and this is from the infamous Chisinau riots. From the judicial investigation of the riots in Chisinau in 1903, the riots were preceded by Jewish fanatics mocking the customs of Palm Sunday, throwing stones, smashing icons. These actions were intended to undermine the respect for the sanctity of faith and to weaken religious feeling. Jews systematically, at every opportunity, tried to shake the authority of the clergy, carefully watching the lives of priests, spreading slander, just to humiliate them in the eyes of the people. A striking example of this is represented by a smear campaign from the Jews against St. John of Kronstadt. And that comes from Platonov, 2005. So, these attacks on processions and churches, This was a purely Jewish phenomenon. And at the local level, they were preparing for what the Soviet Union would do later at the national level. Attacks on the church from Jewish terrorists were reported in the English language press as pogroms against helpless Jews. This is the same British newspapers, by the way, that refused to report on the atrocities against the Orthodox Church throughout the early reign of the USSR. The Kahal and Neshetel system saw the 19th century as a huge threat, as the British did. Not only did you have the industrialization of Russia, on her own terms, by the way, state-controlled currency and banking establishment, huge population growth, the discovery of oil in Baku, that was the last thing. Both Jews and British Empire said they've had enough. And it meant that well-armed, elite, wealthy Jews and their friends staged violent protests against any Orthodox presence in cities with large Jewish populations, and sometimes without. The Jewish elite were kind of gambling, as I've said before, that the significance and the wealth of these regions and the sharp eye, hostile eye of the Western powers will make retaliation impossible. And I have from the state archives, some of these I got from Solzhenitsyn, some of these I got from Platonov. And it goes from city to city. And I'll just mention one again. In Moscow, especially, the rioters acted arrogantly. The so-called Executive Committee of Workers' Deputies, which consisted mainly of Jewish revolutionary terrorists and agitators, declared an armed uprising at 6 p.m. on December 10th. Even instructing cabbies to finish their work at this time. The city was plunged into darkness. The lights were not lit. The streets were illumined by searchlights. Jewish thugs, armed with numerous weapons, walked the streets, killing policemen and officers, as well as any dissidents who refused to remain silent at the sight of these crimes. This is 1905 here. In Kazan, I'll do one more. After Tsar Nicholas's manifesto, now 1906, these, you know, liberal freedoms that he was forced to institutionalize, despite them being in reality anyway. From the State Archives, in Kazan, after the Manifesto of 1906, the leftist Jewish parties formed squads of thugs that completely controlled the city. The governor had become a plaything in the hands of these miscreants. They were not tolerated. On October 21st, at the main square, there were spontaneous gatherings of Russians with national flags and portraits of the king and icons that marched in the streets of Kazan. Meanwhile, in the city council, the Jewish thugs were issued weapons. And this goes everywhere. Starodub in Chernigov, Rostov-on-Don. It's all the same thing. And all of these have gone down in history as pogroms against unarmed and innocent Jews. The cries for genocide against Russia, one of them I quoted from Hearst, are continuing to this very day. The Americans, not knowing anything, treated these Jewish press clippings as absolute evidence to this day. Then they stood silent when Lenin and Trotsky actually carried out the threat on the national and international scale. Socialism in Russia, in its Marxian form, was a Jewish ethnic movement. They eventually became socialist or anarchist movements, but even in the West, Bolshevism was seen as Jewish and ethnic. And then later on, they were referred to as liberators or heroes, and there was no way to contradict what these press reports were saying. In the words of Bakunin, who of course was an anarchist, when the Jews and the Rothschild family began financing Marx, then suddenly socialism was now identified with the state and materialism. Jews in Russia were both ethnic nationalists and Marxists, someone like Moses Hess, many others. None of these movements cared a damn about social egalitarianism. They just used the rhetoric. Naive people, including professors today, still believe it to be the case. But again, without any real critical appraisal of the situation, they don't understand it. At the same time, though, the press reports, even hostile ones, 1905, 1908, in Russia shows the population remaining very pro-royal and patriotic. The violence that became known as pogroms was well-armed Jewish assaults on the Russian population. And the church always was a particularly potent cause of Jewish anger. There was no good reason for socialism to be anti-Christian or to be materialist. The Russian church itself was engaging in many reform, social reform movements, one of my favorites being the Labor Brotherhood of the Holy Cross, which I've dedicated quite a bit of time in the past to. They actually were egalitarian, but they were not materialists. These were some of the first people that were smashed when the Soviets came to power. The church was attacked because Bolshevism was Jewish. In other words, all cases of popular protests against these Jewish and anti-Russian terrors are interpreted to this day by left liberal writers in the English-speaking world as pogroms. Today, over 100 years later, Western historians continue to take the propaganda of these muckrakers as evidence that they could use. This is a horrific level of corruption. They refused to condemn Lenin and Trotsky, and condemned Stalin only because they thought, or had to think, falsely, that Stalin was a nationalist and he was an anti-Semite. But the turn of the 20th century was where this reached the fever pitch. Remember, the white armies were accused of pogroms all the time. This is a classic Trotskyite talking point. Now, I mentioned the number 6 million. And this was one of the more common numbers of victims or potential victims in the English language press. 6 million Jews had been killed or were about to be killed in Ukraine and other parts of Western Russia. And it's in relation to the pogroms that the 6 million figure makes, at least to my knowledge, one of its first appearances, politically speaking. So the Russian Jewish Yearbook of 1911 says this: Russia has since 1890 adopted a deliberate plan to expel or exterminate 6 million of its people. The New York Times wrote in 1905, January 1905, that he declared a free and happy Russia with its 6 million Jews would possibly mean the end of Zionism, since the abolition of the autocracy would practically eliminate the causes that brought Zionism into existence. Which is, by the way, a very chilling statement, because it suggests that Jewish agitation has to be created or invented if the causes for it are not in existence. The New York Times said this all the time. Another one. From 1800 to 1902, he, meaning the crown, caused 6 million Jewish families to be expelled from Russia. In 1911, New York Times says the 6 million Jews of Russia are singled out for systematic oppression and for persecution due to process of law. And I could go on and on. I have the Pittsburgh New Jewish Criterion saying the same thing. The New York Tribune wrote in 1915, what the Turks are doing to Armenians is child's play compared to what Russia is doing to its 6 million Jews, her own subjects. On and on and on. Now, I can't get in too deeply as to why this number. And I've dealt with some of this stuff in the past. But the simple answer, the very simple answer, is that the Hebrew letter Vav is the equivalent of six. It's associated with the hook as well as the nail. And you see this in the Chabad movement. The six is the Jewish number, since they claim it signifies the truth in all dimensions, like the 6 points of the occult hexagram. So the theology, very simplistically, is that 6 million Jews have to be sacrificed so that the Messiah can be induced to come and rule over Israel. Now, sometimes it refers to literal death, sometimes not, but it is a purification ritual. And the Jews will then become their own Messiah. Now, I could get lost in that, and I don't want to. That's just this. I have hundreds of citations concerning the pogroms and more general issues concerning the English language press and Russia between 1900 and the war, using the 6 million figure. Now, I've made the claim, and for many years now, and as does most of the people who I've cited. And I want to quote 200 Years Together, in Volume 2 of 200 Years Together. And here's what he says. Here's what Solzhenitsyn said. It's interesting to note that almost none of the Jewish revolutionaries in these decades went into revolutionary politics to fight misery and poverty. The majority of them were from wealthy families. From wealthy merchant families came Nathanson, Dietz, Joseph Pechtman, Talmudic lawyers, Quotin, Gurevitz, Simon Lurie, the first Italian Marxist, Anna Rosenstein, from a wealthy family, the tragic Moses Rabinovich Kaminsky and Betty Scheftel, Jay Getzoff, and so many others, even Christina Greenberg, from an Orthodox merchant family of great wealth, in 1880 joined the People's Will. She ran a safe house for the terrorists. Alexander Bibergal, Vladimir Borogas, Solomon Aronson, Lazarus Goldenberg, Kotin, Chudnovsky, the Leventhal brothers, all Jewish revolutionaries, every last one of a wealthy merchant background. Now, I've mentioned Odessa. And in 1905, when the strike movement, you know, they were talking about the collapse of Russia and all this nonsense, Jewish parties formed a provisional government in the city. And the urban administration was handed over to armed Jewish thugs. The mayor raised the red flag over Odessa, and they had their own Red Guards, you know, the Antifa of the day, armed Jewish militants on the streets. In the outskirts of the city, Jewish guards ensured that no one came in or out without being searched. They killed policemen all over the place. They killed usually at night, sneaking up in the dark and hitting them in the back. And in Odessa, right, there were about maybe a third of the population by this point, a group of unarmed Russians with portraits of the emperor, icons, and the Russian flags, held a service in public and went around the city past the Jewish outposts, including the so-called Jewish police. And the Jewish militia decided that they needed to be destroyed. They began shooting, one threw a bomb, and then that led to a mass Russian revolt, an uprising of Russians and Ukrainians in the city, and it forced them to flee, and in this government to be put back where it was supposed to be. The rebels were unarmed, or maybe primitive weapons, And that was November 14, 1905. The main hospital in Odessa received 200 wounded Russians and 70 wounded Jews. So you even had a very brief period of the provisional government in Odessa in 1905. People like Vladimir Levitsky, who wrote in the Russian Banner, which was the a royalist newspaper. It was the Black Hundreds and Labor that organized defense brigades in these places against the Jews. And the way that they responded was any attack on a Red organization automatically meant an attack on the Jews, since they were seen as identical. Lenin said the same thing. The Jewish press, whether it be in Kiev, Moscow, Petrograd, created a pogrom. It was almost like a mark that they put on anything that they didn't like. But the Black Hundreds made it clear that even in retaliation, all peaceful Jews be left alone. D.I. Dubrovin said the same thing. The General Council of the Union of the Russian People stated that restraining Russians, given the economic crimes of the Jews, was a difficult task, but that was the official policy. And writers such as D.S. Pasmanik, he came up with 660 riots in Western Russia, some small, some large, roughly in this period of time. And most of them started by the well-armed units of the Jewish Self-Defense Force. And even foreigners coming to Russia saw Marxism there as an ethnic movement. So the average pogrom, you take all of them, no matter how you might define them, about 25% of those who were killed were Jews. The Jewish Reds, Yankel and Pinkus Tarnopolsky, called on Israel to destroy Amalek. Odessa was one of the central locales for all of this. Again, Solzhenitsyn says this. The main occupation of Odessa's Jews in this period was the grain trade. Many Jews were small traders and middlemen, mainly between the landowners and the exporters, as well as agents of prominent foreign and local, mainly Greek, wheat trading companies. At the grain exchange, Jews worked as stockbrokers, appraisers, cashiers, scalers, and loaders. The Jews were in a dominant position in grain commerce. By 1870, most of the grain export was in their hands. In 1910, 89.2% of grain exports were under their control. And that's in Chapter 8. I've mentioned the Pale restrictions, the Pale of settlement. Again, another myth of absurd proportion. It was simply a base for them, about the size of France, tax-free, to dominate. Jews lived all over the empire. But the revolution, 1917, that brought the provisional government to power, not the Bolsheviks, and I've quoted this before, had a few commissions looking into the Tsarist government, and one of them was dedicated to the pogroms. And almost everything that we've been talking about here, they verified. Now, this is a group of people, many of them Jews, who were doing everything in their power to comb through all the records to condemn the royalist government in this and many other areas. And so many of my statistics comes directly from that. So it's not like there wasn't any... and this is, you know, is S.M. Dubovny and Krasnaya Admoni, who led one of the main commissions to study the pogroms after the overthrow of the Tsar. So once the provisional state itself was overturned, you had these mass hunts for anti-Semites. All the time, they were planting rumors, a new pogrom is going to develop here, as an excuse to hunt down anti-Semites, who were the main, according to them, according to the Reds, the main source of counter-revolution. You had poor village clergy being called bourgeois masters, while billionaire Jews are being called proletarians. This happened all the time. There wasn't a Jewish proletariat in Russia at the time. So the entire ethnic aspect of Jewish Marxism didn't make absolutely any sense. Anyway, it was called the Emergency Investigation Committee of the provisional government. Now, I've cited that many times before. Within it, there was a special commission to study the history of the pogroms. I mentioned the two researchers there, the main ones. They found zero violence in Petersburg. They found nothing in Chisinau, which is one of the most famous of them. No documents whatsoever. And in fact, they found a circular from the Interior Ministry that suggested, but didn't mandate, firing for any government worker committed violent action against Jews if it was found out. So, why were these stories created? I'm going to just summarize it this way. Number one, Jewish violence at the time was out of control and purely terrorist in nature. This covered that up, let alone the Soviet era. Number two, it did allow Britain to demonize its main global rival. And number three, it allowed the Jews to depict the Tsar as your typical, stereotype the Jews have of him, this bloodthirsty, ignorant, hypocritical tyrant. But most importantly, it was to cover up, just like the Soviet Holocaust stories were to cover up Stalin's crimes, this covered up the crimes of the early USSR, where it was almost exclusively Jewish. Some of this may sound familiar to you, how the Jewish self-defense forces acted exactly as Antifa does. And the only way that they could be stopped was by the common people. This is why the Union of the Russian People in Ukraine had 1 million members. The very fact that the provisional government found very little evidence for any kind of actual direct pogroms, and yet every American academic still will talk about it like it's the most established fact in the world, says everything you need to know about our world today. Merry Christmas, everyone. Thank you for listening. I will talk to you next time. Bye-bye.